Many MIT courses are of the form. You know, when you go to the first class, you get the syllabus, you look at the list of topics, you say, I don't know anything about these topics, but I sure hope that by the end of the course I know something about these topics. An intro psych class is different from that, because if you take a look at the list of topics in the course, which you can find, by the way, on the back page of the syllabus, but you don't need to go looking for it right now, you will discover, you know, memory, learning, cognition, emotion, personality, intelligence, a whole set of topics that you already have some notion about. They're terms that you use in everyday speech that you can converse about perfectly happily. The job of this course is to dig behind what you would know in what's known as folk psychology. Folk psychology is a term coined in the 19th century to refer to the psychology that folk know, as opposed to the psychology that one would learn in the academy, like you are here. What we used to say, actually, when the term was defined for me in graduate school, I think somebody said, "Folk psychology, that's the psychology that your grandmother knows." That doesn't work so well, because your grandmother may well have a PhD in psychology these days. Folk psychology is what the psychology that you would know without bothering to take a course like that. This, like the psychology you just pick up on the street. This course is designed to go beyond that. Well, yeah. Let me dig up an example. Let me close the door. And as an example, I could assert. Oh, let's see. I need a person. Well, this is why one sits in the front row. You're a person.
Yes.
That's very good. What's your name?
Hi, I'm Mark.
You're Mark. Okay. Who is that woman sitting next to you?
This is Laura.
This is Laura. Okay. I could say that Mark loves Laura. It may or may not be true. For all I know, Mark is. It is true. This is. This is this is going to be a more interesting example than sometimes. But all right, if I assert that that Mark loves Laura without much knowledge of either Mark or Laura here, that's not a sentence that's hard for you to understand. But what is it that we're actually talking about? What's love? I didn't check this morning, but I didn't check. I think that probably the line you would get in a dictionary would assert that love is an emotion, and then it would go on to describe what kind of an emotion it is. But it's an odd emotion, if it is an emotion. If you think about other emotions that are pretty straightforward, let's say sadness or happiness, to give two straightforward examples, you know what sadness and happiness feel like. They have a distinctive feeling to them. There is a distinctive feeling to being in love. There's no doubt that there's a feeling aspect. It's actually an interesting question why we use the same word feeling to talk about feeling in love and feeling the table. What's the commonality there? But the feeling of being in love is not simple in the same way that the feeling of sadness or the feeling of happiness is. For instance, you can be sad or happy in love, right? That you can be in love, and the experience of that could be either sad or happy. The experience of being sad cannot be either sad or sad is sad. It's in some sense an atomic sensation in a way that love does not appear to be. You can wake up in the morning feeling sad, disembodied sort of sadness, or disembodied sort of happiness. You can't really, it's hard to imagine what it would be to wake up and say, I feel love. It's not clear that makes sort of a quasi-religious sense that you could get to it. You know, I feel love for the whole universe or something like that. That's lovely, but You see the distinction. So maybe it's not an emotion in the simple sense that sadness or happiness is. Maybe it's a way of thinking about your current state. You know, I feel happy and my heart is pounding and I'm sitting next to, oh God, I've forgotten her name already, Laura. Lara. No, you. L-A-R-A, Lara. And Mark. They have two letters in common. That's the basis for this relationship. Anyway, you know, so, you know, where was I? You're not going to wake up feeling a disembodied sense of love. Maybe you're thinking, maybe what it is a thought about the state that you are currently in. So maybe it's a cognition rather than an emotion. But if it's a cognition, it's a different kind of cognition from what you might think of as a sort of an atomic cognition, because it has this aspect of feeling to it that other cognitions don't. Like, what's the capital of Equatorial Guinea? I have no idea, but it's a thought. I can think about that fact. It doesn't carry with it any deep feeling unless it turns out to be a question on the final exam. But you can have thoughts that aren't colored in this emotional kind of a way. So it's not a simple cognition. It might be more useful to call it a motivation than to call it an emotion. Motivations are like emotions in the sense of having this affective, affect is the sort of jargony term for feeling, this affective component to it. But the sorts of things that get talked about as motivations are things like thirst. So, it being warm, I'm thirsty. That's a faintly unpleasant state, and a motivation is something that motivates me to do something to change my state. And, you know, hunger, another good example. So what kind of motivation would love be? Love might be a motivation that it's directed to an object of some sort, and it's I knew I shouldn't have caught that cold from that third grader in my house. That's better. It's a motivation that, if love is a motivation, what it's motivating you to do is to perhaps get closer to possess the object of desire. Now, Mark and Lara are busy sitting there saying, oh boy, that doesn't sound so good. But love, of course, can be used not just in the Mark and Lara sense, but, you know, you can love your laptop or something like that and you know, have... We won't go there, Mark. It's okay. But that does lead you. Those are two clearly sort of different senses of love, and or at least your chortling suggests that you think of them in different senses. You might ask what love is for. If thirst is a motivation, it's because you need liquid in order to be alive, right? And you don't drink stuff, you're going to be dead. What's love for? Well, the usual answers to that these days in psychology would come out of the chunk of psychology that's called evolutionary psychology that sees these core motivations, if you like, as things that evolved over the history of the species and of life in general to serve useful purposes for the organism. In this case, love is presumably in service of that great evolutionary good, which is to get your genes into the next generation. That the goal of that your goal, if you're a thoroughgoing evolutionary psychologist, your goal in life basically is to get genes into the next generation, to perpetuate your genes. And, you know, the sex and reproduction thing is a good way to do that. It's not the only way to do that, it's important to note. How many of you are only children? Well, no, actually, let's go the other way. How many of you have siblings? Okay, one way for you to gain this sort of evolutionary immortality of getting your genes into the next generation is to be a really good aunt or uncle, right? You protect and preserve that little niece or nephew of yours, and they're carrying a bundle of your genes, too. So it's not that you know, having and raising children is the only evolutionary route to the future. But it is a good one. And the love business would seem to be related to that. But it's not necessary. If you think about it, well, all right, spiders. Let's think of spiders. Spiders, the reproduction thing works fine with spiders. It's not clear how much love and romance there is involved. If you look at spider behavior, it doesn't look much like romantic love. I mean, the guy spends most of his time trying to avoid being killed by the female spider, who is typically much bigger.